around him, and from time to time a scream would pierce the air, thick with pain. When he tried to move, he found that he had fouled his own bedding. The smoke in the air made his eyes water. Am I crying? He must not let his father see. He was a Lannister of Castle Rock. A lion? I must be a lion. Live a lion. Die a lion. He hurt so much, though. Too weak to groan. He lay in his own filth and shut his eyes. Nearby, someone was cursing the gods in a heavy, monotonous tone. He listened to the blasphemies and wondered if he was dying. After a time, the room faded. He found himself outside the city, walking through a world without color. Ravens soared through a gray sky on wide black wings, while carrion crows rose from their feasts in furious clouds wherever he set his steps. White maggots burrowed through black corruption. The wolves were gray, and so were the Silent Sisters. Together they stripped the flesh from the fallen. There were corpses strewn all over the tawny fields. The sun was a hot white penny, shining down upon the gray river as it rushed around the charred bones of sunken ships. From the pyres of the dead rose black columns of smoke and white-hot ashes. My work, thought Tyrion Lannister. They died at my command. At first, there was no sound in the world, but after a time, he began to hear the voices of the dead, soft and terrible. They wept and moaned. They begged for an end to pain. They cried for help and wanted their mothers. Tyrion had never known his mother. He wanted Shae, but she was not there. He walked alone amidst the gray shadows, trying to remember. The Silent Sisters were stripping the dead men of their armor and clothes. All the bright dyes had leached out from the surcoats of the slain. They were garbed in shades of white and gray, and their blood was black and crusty. He watched their naked bodies lifted by arm and leg to be carried swinging to the pyres to join their fellows. Metal and cloth were thrown in the back of a white wooden wagon pulled by two tall black horses. So many dead, so very many. Their corpses hung limply, their faces slack or stiff or swollen with gas, unrecognizable, hardly human. The garments the sisters took from them were decorated with black hearts, gray lions, dead flowers, and pale, ghostly stags. Their armor was all dented and gashed, the chainmail riven, broken, slashed. Why did I kill them all? He had known once, but somehow he had forgotten. He would have asked one of the Silent Sisters, but when he tried to speak, he found he had no mouth. Smooth, seamless skin covered his teeth. The discovery terrified him. How could he live without a mouth? He began to run. The city was not far. He would be safe inside the city, away from all these dead. He did not belong with the dead. He had no mouth, but he was still a living man. No, a lion, and alive. But when he reached the city walls, the gates were shut against him. It was dark when he woke again. At first he could see nothing, but after a time, the vague outlines of a bed appeared around him. The drapes were drawn, but he could see the shape of curved bedposts and the droop of the velvet canopy over his head. Under him was the yielding softness of a feather bed, and the pillow beneath his head was goose down. My own bed? I am in my own bed, in my own bedchamber. It was warm inside the drapes, under the great heap of furs and blankets that covered him. He was sweating. Fever, he thought groggily. He felt so weak, and the pain stabbed through him when he struggled to lift his hand. He gave up the effort. His head felt enormous, as big as the bed, too heavy to raise from the pillow. His body he could scarcely feel at all. How did I come here? He tried to remember. The battle came back in fits and flashes. The fight along the river, the knight who'd offer up his gauntlet, the bridge of ships. Sir Mandon, He saw the dead, empty eyes, the reaching hand, the green fire shining against the white enamel plate. Fear swept over him in a cold rush. Beneath the sheets, he could feel his bladder letting go. He would have cried out if he'd had a mouth. No, that was the dream, he thought, his head pounding. Help me. Someone help me. Jamie, Shay, Mother, someone, Taisha. No one heard. No one came. Alone in the dark, he fell back into piss-scented sleep. He dreamed his sister was standing over his bed with their Lord Father beside her, frowning. It had to be a dream, since Lord Tywin was 1,000 leagues away, fighting Robb Stark in the west. Others came and went as well. Varys looked down on him and sighed, but Littlefinger made a quip. Bloody, treacherous bastard, Tyrion thought venomously. We sent you to Bitterbridge, and you never came back. Sometimes he could hear them talking to one another, but he did not understand the words. Their voices buzzed in his ears like wasps muffled in thick felt. He wanted to ask if they'd won the battle. We must have. Yes, I'd be ahead on a spike somewhere. If I live, we won. He did not know what pleased him more, the victory or the fact he'd been able to reason it out. His wits were coming back to him, however slowly. That was good. His wits were all he had. The next time he woke, the draperies had been pulled back, and Podrick Payne stood over him with a candle. When he saw Tyrion open his eyes, he ran off. No, don't go. Help me. Help! He tried to call, but the best he could do was a muffled moan. I have no mouth. He raised a hand to his face, his every movement pained and fumbling. His fingers found stiff cloth where they should have found flesh, lips, teeth. Linen! The lower half of his face was bandaged tightly, a mask of hardened plaster with holes for breathing and feeding. A short while later, Pod reappeared. This time, a stranger was with him, a maester chained and robed.
My lord, you must be still, the man murmured. You are grievous hurt, and you will do yourself great injury. Are you thirsty?
He managed an awkward nod. The maester inserted a curved copper funnel through the feeding hole over his mouth and poured a slow trickle down his throat. Tyrion swallowed, scarcely tasting. Too late he realized the liquid was milk of the poppy. By the time the maester removed the funnel from his mouth, he was already spiraling back to sleep. This time, he dreamed he was at a feast, a victory feast, in some great hall. He had a high seat on the dais, and men were lifting their goblets and hailing him as hero. Merillion was there, the singer who journeyed with them through the mountains of the moon. He played his wood harp and sang of the imp's daring deeds. Even his father was smiling with approval. When the song was over, Jaime rose from his place, commanded Tyrion to kneel, and touched him first on one shoulder and then on the other with his golden sword, and he rose up a knight. Shay was waiting to embrace him. She took him by the hand, laughing and teasing, calling him her Giant of Lannister. He woke in darkness to a cold, empty room. The draperies had been drawn again. Something felt wrong, turned around, though he could not have said what. He was alone once more. Pushing back the blankets, he tried to sit, but the pain was too much, and he soon subsided, breathing raggedly. His face was the least part of it. His right side was one huge ache, and a stab of pain went through his chest whenever he lifted his arm. What's happened to me? Even the battle seemed half a dream when he tried to think back on it. I was hurt more badly than I knew. Samandon. The memory frightened him. But Tyrion made himself hold it, turn it in his head, stare at it hard. He tried to kill me. No mistake. That part was not a dream. He would have cut me in half
if Pod had not... Pod? Where's Pod?
Gritting his teeth, he grabbed hold of the bed hangings and yanked. The drapes ripped free of the canopy overhead and tumbled down, half on the rushes and half on him. Even that small effort had dizzied him. The room whirled around him, all bare walls and dark shadows, with a single narrow window. He saw a chest he'd owned, an untidy pile of his clothing, his battered armor. "This is not my bedchamber," he realized. "Not even the Tower of the Hand." Someone had moved him. His shout of anger came out as a muffled moan.
"They have moved me here to die,"
he thought as he gave up the struggle and closed his eyes once more. The room was dank and cold, and he was burning. He dreamed of a better place, a snug little cottage by the sunset sea. The walls were lopsided and cracked, and the floor had been made of packed earth, but it had always been warm there, even when they let the fire go out. "She used to tease me about this," he remembered. "I never thought to feed the fire. That had always been a servant's task." "We have no servants," she would remind me, and I would say, "You have me. I'm your servant." And she would say, "A lazy servant. What do they do with lazy servants in Castle Rock, my lord?" And I would tell her, "They kiss them." That would always make her giggle. "They do not neither. They beat them, I bet," she would say. And I would insist, "No, they kiss them, just like this." I would show her how. "They kiss their fingers first, every one, and they kiss their wrists, yes, and inside their elbows, then they kiss their funny ears. All our servants have funny ears. Stop laughing. And they kiss their cheeks, and they kiss their noses with a little bump in them. There, so, like that, and then they kiss their sweet brows, and their hair, and their lips, their, mouths, so." They would kiss for hours and spend whole days doing no more than lolling in bed, listening to the waves, and touching each other. Her body was a wonder to him, and she seemed to find delight in his. Sometimes she would sing to him, "I loved a maid as fair as summer with sunlight in her hair." "I love you, Tyrion," she would whisper before they went to sleep at night. "I love your lips. I love your voice and the words you say to me and how you treat me gentle. I love your face."
"My face?"
"Yes. Yes, I love your hands and how you touch me. Your cock. I love your cock. I love how it feels when it's in me."
"It loves you too, my lady."
"I love to say your name. Tyrion Lannister. It goes with mine. Not the Lannister, t'other part. Tyrion and Tysha. Tysha and Tyrion. Tyrion. My Lord Tyrion."
Lies, he thought. All feigned. All for gold. She was a whore. Jamie's whore. Jamie's gift. My lady of the lie.
Her face seemed to fade away, dissolving behind a veil of tears. But even after she was gone, he could still hear the faint, far-off sound of her voice, calling his name. "My lord, can you hear me? My lord, Tyrion, my lord, my lord."
Through a haze of poppied sleep, he saw a soft pink face leaning over him. He was back in the dank room with the torn bed hangings, and the face was wrong, not hers, too round, with a brown fringe of beard.
"Do you thirst, my lord? I have your milk, your good milk. You must not fight, no. Don't try to move. You need your rest."
He had the copper funnel in one damp pink hand and a flask in the other. As the man leaned closer, Tyrion's fingers slid underneath his chain of many metals, grabbed, pulled. The maester dropped the flask, spilling milk of the poppy all over the blanket. Tyrion twisted until he could feel the links digging into the flesh of the man's fat neck.
"No more,"
he croaked, so hoarse he was not certain he had even spoken. But he must have, for the maester choked out a reply.
on hand, please, my lord. Need your milk, the pain, the chain, don't on hand, no.
The pink face was beginning to purple when Tyrion let go. The maester reeled back, sucking in air. His reddened throat showed deep white gouges where the lynx had pressed. His eyes were white too. Tyrion raised a hand to his face and made a ripping motion over the hardened mask, and again and again.
You want the bandages off, is that it?
The maester said at last.
But I'm not to... That would be most unwise, my lord. You are not yet healed. The queen would...
The mention of his sister made Tyrion growl.
Are you one of hers, then?
He pointed a finger at the maester, then coiled his hand into a fist. Crushing, choking, a promise, unless the fool did as he was bid. Thankfully, he understood.
I will do as my lord commands, to be sure, but this is unwise. Your wounds.
Do it. Louder that time. Bowing, the man left the room, only to return a few moments later, bearing a long knife with a slender, saw-toothed blade, a basin of water, a pile of soft cloths, and several flasks. By then, Tyrion had managed to squirm backward a few inches, so he was half sitting against his pillow. The maester bade him be very still as he slid the tip of the knife in under his chin beneath the mask. A slip of the blade here, and Cersei would be free of me, he thought. He could feel the blade sawing through the stiffened linen, only inches above his throat. Fortunately, this soft pink man was not one of his sister's braver creatures. After a moment, he felt cool air on his cheeks. There was pain as well, but he did his best to ignore it. The maester discarded the bandages, still crusty with potion.
Be still now. I must wash out the wound.
His touch was gentle, the water warm and soothing. The wound, Tyrion thought, remembering a sudden flash of bright silver that seemed to pass just below his eyes.
This is like to sting some, the maester warned as he wet a cloth with wine that smelled of crushed herbs.
It did more than sting. It traced a line of fire all the way across Tyrion's face and twisted the burning poker up his nose. His fingers clawed the bedclothes and he sucked in his breath, but somehow he managed not to scream. The maester was clucking like an old hen.
It would have been wiser to leave the mask in place until the flesh had knit, my lord. Still, it looks clean. Good, good. When we found you down in that cellar among the dead and dying, your wounds were filthy. One of your ribs was broken. Doubtless you can feel it. The blow of some mace, perhaps, or a fall. It's hard to say. And you took an arrow in the arm, there where it joins the shoulder. It showed signs of mortification, and for a time I feared you might lose the limb. But we treated it with boiling wine and maggots, and now it seems to be healing clean.
Name!
Tyrion breathed up at him.
Name!
The maester blinked.
Why, you are Tyrion Lannister, my lord, a brother to the queen. Do you remember the battle? Sometimes with head wounds.
Your name!
His throat was raw, and his tongue had forgotten how to shape the words.
I am Maester Balibar.
Balibar, Tyrion repeated. Bring me looking glass.
My lord, the maester said, I would not counsel. That might be unwise, as it were. Your wound.
Bring it, he had to say. His mouth was stiff and sore, as if a punch had split his lip.
And drink wine. No puppy.
The maester rose, flush-faced, and hurried off. He came back with a flagon of pale amber wine and a small silvered-looking glass in an ornate golden frame. Sitting on the edge of the bed, he poured half a cup of wine and held it to Tyrion's swollen lips. The trickle went down cool, though he could hardly taste it.
More,
he said, when the cup was empty. Maester Balibar poured again. By the end of the second cup, Tyrion Lannister felt strong enough to face his face. He turned over the glass and did not know whether he ought to laugh or cry. The gash was long and crooked, starting a hair under his left eye and ending up on the right side of his jaw. 3/4 of his nose was gone, and a chunk of his lip. Someone had sewn the torn flesh together with catgut, and their clumsy stitches were still in place across the seam of raw, red, half-heel flesh. "Pretty," he croaked, flinging the glass aside. He remembered now the bridge of boats, Sir Mandon Moore, a hand, a sword coming at his face. "If I had not pulled back, that cut would have taken off the top of my head." Jamie had always said that Sir Mandon was the most dangerous of the King's Guard because his dead, empty eyes gave no hint to his intentions. I should never have trusted any of them. He'd known that Sir Meryn and Sir Boris were his sisters, and Sir Osmond later, but he'd let himself believe that the others were not wholly lost to honor. "Cersei must have paid him to see that I never came back from the battle. Why else? I never did Sir Mandon any harm that I know of." Tyrion touched his face, plucking at the proud flesh with blunt, thick fingers. "Another gift from my sweet sister." The maester stood beside the bed like a goose about to take flight.
"My lord, there will most like be a scar."
"Most like?" His snort of laughter turned into a wince of pain.
There would be a scar, to be sure. Nor was it likely that his nose would be growing back any time soon. It was not as if his face had ever been fit to look at.
"Teach me not to play with axes." His grin felt tight. "Where are we? What place?"
It hurt to talk, but Tyrion had been too long in silence.
"Ah, you are in Maegor's Holdfast, my lord. A chamber over the Queen's ballroom. Her Grace wanted you kept close so she might watch over you herself."
"I'll wager she did."
"Return me,"
Tyrion commanded.
"Own bed, own chambers.
Where I will have my own men about me, and my own maester too, if I can find one I can trust."
"Your own, my lord, would not be possible. The King's Hand has taken up residence in your former chambers."
"I am King's Hand."
He was growing exhausted by the effort of speaking and confused by what he was hearing. Maester Balibar looked distressed.
"No, my lord, you were wounded, near death. Your lord father has taken up those duties now. Lord Tywin, here. Since the night of the battle, Lord Tywin saved us all. The small folk say it was King Renly's ghost, but wiser men know better. It was your father and Lord Tyrell, with a knight of flowers and Lord Littlefinger. They rode through the ashes and took the usurper Stannis in the rear. It was a great victory. And now Lord Tywin has settled into the Tower of the Hand to help his grace set the realm to rights. Gods be praised."
"Gods be praised,"
Tyrion repeated hollowly.
"His bloody father and bloody Littlefinger and Renly's ghost? Who do I want?"
He could not tell Pink Balibar to fetch him Shay. Who could he send for? Who could he trust? Varys? Bronn? Sir Jesslyn?
"My squire," he finished. "Pod. Pain."
It was Pod on the bridge of boats. The lad saved my life.
"The boy? The odd boy?"
"Odd boy. Podrick Pain. You go. Send him."
"As you will, my lord."
Maester Balibar bobbed his head and hurried out. Tyrion could feel the strength seeping out of him as he waited. He wondered how long he had been here, asleep. "Cersei would have me sleep forever. but I won't be so obliging. Podrick Payne entered the bedchamber, timid as a mouse. My lord? He crept close to the bed. How can a boy so bold in battle be so frightened in a sick room? Tyrion wondered. I meant to stay by you, but the maester sent me away.
Send him away? Hear me? Talks hard. Need a dream wine. Dream wine, not milk of the puppy. Go to Franken. Franken, not Badabar. Watch him make it. Bring it here.
Pod stole a glance at Tyrion's face and just as quickly averted his eyes. Well, I cannot blame him for that.
I want, Tyrion went on, mine own guard, Bronn. Where's Bronn?
They made him a knight. Even frowning hurt.
Find him. Bring him.
As you say, my lord, Bronn. Tyrion seized the lad's wrist.
Sir Mandon?
The boy flinched.
I never meant to... Dead? You're certain? Dead?
The boy shuffled his feet sheepishly.
Drowned. Good. Say nothing. Of him? Of me? Any of it? Nothing.
By the time his squire had left, the last of Tyrion's strength was gone as well. He lay back and closed his eyes. Perhaps he would dream of Tysha again.
I wonder how she'd like my face now, he thought bitterly.
John. When Corran Halfhand told him to find some brush for a fire, John knew their end was near. It will be good to feel warm again, if only for a little while, he told himself while he hacked bare branches from the trunk of a dead tree. Ghost sat on his haunches watching, silent as ever. Will he howl for me when I'm dead? As Bran's wolf howled when he fell, John wondered. Will Shaggy Dog howl far off in Winterfell, and Grey Wind and Nymeria, wherever they might be? The moon was rising behind one mountain and the sun sinking behind another as John struck sparks from flint and dagger until finally a wisp of smoke appeared. Corran came and stood over him as the first flame rose up, flickering from the shavings of bark and dead dry pine needles.
As shy as a maiden on her wedding night, the big ranger said in a soft voice, and near as fair. Sometimes a man forgets how pretty a fire can be.
He was not a man you'd expect to speak of maids and wedding nights. So far as John knew, Corran had spent his whole life in the watch.
Did he ever love a maid or have a wedding?
He could not ask. Instead, he fanned the fire. When the blaze was all a crackle, he peeled off his stiff gloves to warm his hands and sighed, wondering if ever a kiss had felt as good. The warmth spread through his fingers like melting butter. The half-hand eased himself to the ground and sat cross-legged by the fire, the flickering light playing across the hard planes of his face. Only the two of them remained of the five rangers who had fled the Skirling Pass back into the blue-grey wilderness of the Frostfangs. At first John had nursed the hope that Squire Dalbridge would keep the wildlings bottled up in the pass. But when they'd heard the call of a far-off horn, every man of them knew that the squire had fallen. Later they spied the eagle soaring through the dusk on great blue-grey wings, and Stone Snake unslung his bow. But the bird flew out of range before he could so much as string it. Ebon spat and muttered darkly of wargs and skin changers. They glimpsed the eagle twice more the day after and heard the hunting horn behind them echoing against the mountains. Each time it seemed a little louder, a little closer. When night fell, the half-hand told Ebon to take the squire's garron as well as his own and ride east for Mormont with all haste, back the way they had come. The rest of them would draw off the pursuit.
Send John, Ebon had urged. He can ride as fast as me.
John has a different part to play. He is half a boy still. No, said Corin. He is a man of the night's watch. When the moon rose, Eben parted from them. Stone Snake went east with him a short way, then doubled back to obscure their tracks, and the three who remained set off toward the southwest. After that, the days and nights blurred one into the other. They slept in their saddles and stopped only long enough to feed and water the Garrons, then mounted up again. Over bare rock they rode, through gloomy pine forests and drifts of old snow, over icy ridges and across shallow rivers that had no names. Sometimes Corin or Stone Snake would loop back to sweep away their tracks, but it was a futile gesture. They were watched. At every dawn and every dusk, they saw the eagle soaring between the peaks, no more than a speck in the vastness of the sky. They were scaling a low ridge between two snow-capped peaks when a shadow cat came snarling from its lair, not 10 yards away. The beast was gaunt and half-starved, but the sight of it sent Stone Snake's mare into a panic. She reared and ran, and before the ranger could get her back under control, she had stumbled on the steep slope and broken a leg. Ghost ate well that day, and Corin insisted that the rangers mix some of the Garen's blood with their oats to give them strength. The taste of that foul porridge almost choked John, but he forced it down. They each cut a dozen strips of raw, stringy meat from the carcass to chew on as they rode, and left the rest for the Shadow Cats. There was no question of riding double. Stone Snake offered to lay in wait for the pursuit and surprise them when they came. Perhaps he could take a few of them with him down to hell? Corin refused. If any man in the Night's Watch can make it through the Frost Fangs alone and afoot, it is you, brother. You can go over mountains that a horse must go around. Make for the fist. Tell Mormont what John saw and how. Tell him that the old powers are waking, that he faces giants and wargs and worse. Tell him that the trees have eyes again. He has no chance, John thought, when he watched Stone Snake vanish over a snow-covered ridge, a tiny black bug crawling across a rippling expanse of white. After that, every night seemed colder than the night before, and more lonely. Ghost was not always with them, but he was never far either. Even when they were apart, John sensed his nearness. He was glad for that. The half-hand was not the most companionable of men. Corin's long grey braid swung slowly with the motion of his horse. Often they would ride for hours without a word spoken. The only sounds, the soft scrape of horseshoes on stone and the keening of the wind which blew endlessly through the heights. When he slept, he did not dream, not of wolves, nor his brothers, nor anything. Even dreams cannot live up here, he told himself. Is your sword sharp, Jon Snow? Asked Corin Halfhand across the flickering fire. My sword is Valyrian steel. The old bear gave it to me. Do you remember the words of your vow? Yes. They were not words a man was like to forget. Once said, they could never be unsaid. They changed your life forever. Say them again with me, Jon Snow. If you like. Their voices blended as one beneath the rising moon, while ghosts listened and the mountains themselves bore witness. Night gathers, and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn, the horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men. I pledge my life and honor to the Night's Watch for this night and all the nights to come. When they were done, there was no sound but the faint crackle of the flames and a distant sigh of wind. John opened and closed his burnt fingers, holding tight to the words in his mind. praying that his father's gods would give him the strength to die bravely when his hour came. It would not be long now. The Garrons were near the end of their strength. Corran's Mount would not last another day, John suspected. The flames were burning low by then, the warmth fading.
The fire will soon go out, Corran said. But if the wall should ever fall, all the fires would go out.
There was nothing John could say to that. He nodded.
We may escape them yet, the ranger said. Or not.
I'm not afraid to die. It was only half a lie.
It may not be so easy as that, John.
He did not understand. What do you mean?
If we are taken, you must yield.
Yield? He blinked in disbelief. The wildlings did not make captives of the men they call the crows. They killed them, except for... They only spare oathbreakers, those who join them, like Mance Raider.
And you?
No, he shook his head. Never, I won't.
You will. I command it of you.
Command it, but...
Our honor means no more than our lives, so long as the realm is safe. Are you a man of the Night's Watch?
Yes, but there is no but, Jon Snow. You are, or you are not. Jon sat up straight. I am.
Then hear me. If we are taken, you will go over to them, as the wildling girl you captured once urged you. They may demand that you cut your cloak to ribbons, that you swear them an oath on your father's grave, that you curse your brothers and your Lord Commander. You must not balk. Whatever is asked of you, do as they bid you. But in your heart, remember who and what you are. Ride with them, eat with them, fight with them, for as long as it takes. And watch.
For what? John asked.
Would that I knew, said Corran. Your wolf saw their diggings in the Valley of the Milkwater. What did they seek in such a bleak and distant place? Did they find it? That is what you must learn before you return to Lord Mormont and your brothers. That is the duty I lay on you, Jon Snow.
I'll do as you say, Jon said reluctantly. But you will tell them, won't you? The old bear, at least. You'll tell him that I never broke my oath. Corran Halfhand gazed at him across the fire, his eyes lost in pools of shadow.
When I see him next, I swear it.
He gestured at the fire.
More wood. I want it bright and hot.
John went to cut more branches, snapping each one in two before tossing it into the flames. The tree had been dead a long time, but it seemed to live again in the fire, as fiery dancers woke within each stick of wood to whirl and spin in their glowing gowns of yellow, red, and orange.
Enough, Corran said abruptly. Now we ride.
Ride? It was dark beyond the fire. The night was cold. Ride where?
Back.
Corran mounted his weary Garrun one more time.
The fire will draw them past, I hope. Come, brother.
John pulled on his gloves again and raised his hood. Even the horses seemed reluctant to leave the fire. The sun was long gone, and only the cold silver shine of the half-moon remained to light their way over the treacherous ground that lay behind them. He did not know what Corran had in mind, but perhaps it was a chance. He hoped so. I do not want to play the oathbreaker, even for good reason. They went cautiously, moving as silent as man and horse could move, retracing their steps until they reached the mouth of a narrow defile, where an icy little stream emerged from between two mountains. John remembered the place. They had watered the horses here before the sun went down.
The water's icing up,
Corran observed as he turned aside.
Else we'd ride in the stream bed. But if we break the ice, they're like to see. Keep close to the cliffs. There's a crook a half mile on that will hide us.
He rode into the defile. John gave one last wistful look at their distant fire and followed. The farther in they went, the closer the cliffs pressed to either side. They followed the moonlit ribbon of stream, back toward its source. Icicles bearded its stony banks, but John could still hear the sound of rushing water beneath the thin, hard crust. A great jumble of fallen rock blocked their way partway up, where a section of the cliff face had fallen. But the sure-footed little Garrons were able to pick their way through. Beyond, the walls pinched in sharply, and the stream led them to the foot of a tall, twisting waterfall. The air was full of mist, like the breath of some vast, cold beast. The tumbling waters shone silver in the moonlight. John looked about in dismay. There is no way out. He and Curran might be able to climb the cliffs, but not with the horses. He did not think they would last long afoot. "Quickly now," the half-hand commanded. The big man on the small horse rode over the ice-slick stones right into the curtain of water and vanished. When he did not reappear, John put his heels into his horse and went after. His Garen did his best to shy away. The falling water slapped at them with frozen fists, and the shock of the cold seemed to stop John's breath. Then he was through, drenched and shivering, but through. The cleft in the rock was barely large enough for man and horse to pass, but beyond, the walls opened up and the floor turned to soft sand. John could feel the spray freezing in his beard. Ghost burst through the waterfall in an angry rush, shook droplets from his fur, sniffed at the darkness suspiciously, then lifted a leg against one rocky wall. Curran had already dismounted. John did the same. "You knew this place was here?"
"When I was no older than you, I heard a brother tell how he followed a shadow cat through these falls."
He unsaddled his horse, removed her bitten bridle, and ran his fingers through her shaggy mane.
"There is a way through the heart of the mountain. Come dawn, if they have not found us, we will press on. The first watch is mine, brother."
Curran seated himself on the sand, his back to a wall, no more than a vague black shadow in the gloom of the cave. Over the rush of falling water, John heard the soft sound of steel on leather that could only mean that the half-hand had drawn his sword. He took off his wet cloak, but it was too cold and damp here to strip down any further. Ghost stretched out beside him and licked his glove before curling up to sleep. John was grateful for his warmth. He wondered if the fire was still burning outside or if it had gone out by now. If the wall should ever fall, all the fires will go out. The moon shone through the curtain of falling water to lay a shimmering pale stripe across the sand, but after a while, that too faded and went dark. Sleep came at last, and with it, nightmares. He dreamed of burning castles and dead men rising unquiet from their graves. It was still dark when Curran woke him. While the half-hand slept, John sat with his back to the cave wall, listening to the water and waiting for the dawn. At break of day, they each chewed a half-frozen strip of horse meat, then saddled their Garrons once again and fastened their black cloaks around their shoulders. During his watch, the half-hand had made a half-dozen torches, soaking bundles of dry moss with the oil he carried in his saddlebag. He lit the first one now and led the way down into the dark, holding the pale flame up before him. John followed with the horses. The stony path twisted and turned, first down, then up, then down more steeply. In spots it grew so narrow, it was hard to convince the Garrons they could squeeze through. "By the time we come out, we will have lost them," he told himself as they went. "Not even an eagle can see through solid stone. We will have lost them, and we will ride hard for the fist and tell the old bear all we know." But when they emerged back into the light, long hours later, the eagle was waiting for them, perched on a dead tree 100 feet up the slope. Ghost went bounding up the rocks after it, but the bird flapped its wings and took to the air. Corrin's mouth tightened as he followed its flight with his eyes. Here is as good a place as any to make a stand, he declared. The mouth of the cave shelters us from above, and they cannot get behind us without passing through the mountain. Is your sword sharp, Jon Snow?
Yes, he said.
We'll feed the horses. They've served us bravely, poor beasts.
Jon gave his Garin the last of the oats and stroked his shaggy mane while Ghost prowled restlessly amongst the rocks. He pulled his gloves on tighter and flexed his burnt fingers. I am the shield that guards the realms of men. A hunting horn echoed through the mountains, and a moment later Jon heard the baying of hounds.
They will be with us soon, announced Corrin. Keep your wolf in hand.
Ghost, to me, Jon called. The direwolf returned reluctantly to his side, tail held stiffly behind him. The wildlings came boiling over a ridge not half a mile away. Their hounds ran before them, snarling, grey-brown beasts with more than a little wolf in their blood. Ghost bared his teeth, his fur bristling. Easy, Jon murmured. Stay. Overhead, he heard the rustle of wings. The eagle landed on an outcrop of rock and screamed in triumph. The hunters approached warily, perhaps fearing arrows. Jon counted 14, with 8 dogs. Their large, round shields were made of skins stretched over woven wicker and painted with skulls. About half of them hid their faces behind crude helms of wood and boiled leather. On either wing, archers notched shafts to the strings of small wooden horn bows, but did not loose. The rest seemed to be armed with spears and mauls. One had a chipped stone axe. They wore only what bits of armor they had looted from dead rangers or stolen during raids. Wildlings did not mine or smelt, and there were few smiths and fewer forges north of the wall. Corrin drew his longsword. The tale of how he had taught himself to fight with his left hand after losing half of his right was part of his legend. It was said that he handled a blade better now than he ever had before. Jon stood shoulder to shoulder with the big ranger and pulled Longclaw from its sheath. Despite the chill in the air, sweat stung his eyes. 10 yards below the cave mouth, the hunters halted. Their leader came on alone, riding a beast that seemed more goat than horse from the sure-footed way it climbed the uneven slope. As man and mount grew nearer, Jon could hear them clattering. Both were armored in bones, cow bones, sheep bones, the bones of goats and oryx and elk, the great bones of the hairy mammoths, and human bones as well.
Rattleshirt, Corrin called down, icy polite. To crows I be the Lord of Bones.
The rider's helm was made from the broken skull of a giant, and all up and down his arms bear claws had been sewn to his boiled leather. Corrin snorted.
I see no lord, only a dog dressed in chicken bones who rattles when he rides.
The wildling hissed in anger, and his mount reared.
He did rattle. Jon could hear it.
The bones were strung together loosely, so they clacked and clattered when he moved.
It's your bones I'll be rattling soon off, and I'll boil the flesh off you and make a burnie from your ribs. I'll carve your teeth to cast me runes and eat me oaten porridge from your skull. If you want my bones, come get them.
That, Rattleshirt seemed reluctant to do. His numbers meant little in the close confines of the rocks where the Black Brothers had taken their stand. To winkle them out of the cave, the wildlings would need to come up 2 at a time. But another of his company edged a horse up beside him, one of the fighting women called spearwives.
We are 4 and 10 to 2, crows, and 8 dogs to your wolf, she called. Fight or run, you are ours. Show them, commanded Rattleshirt.
The woman reached into a blood-stained sack and drew out a trophy. Ebon had been as bald as an egg, so she dangled the head by an ear.
He died brave, she said. But he died, said Rattleshirt. Same like you.
He freed his battle axe brandishing it above his head. Good steel it was, with a wicked gleam to both blades. Eben was never a man to neglect his weapons. The other wildlings crowded forward beside him, yelling taunts. A few chose John for their mockery.
"Is that your wolf, boy?"
a skinny youth called, unlimbering a stone flail.
"He'll be my cloak before the sun is down."
On the other side of the line, another spearwife opened her ragged furs to show John a heavy white breast.
"Does the baby want his mama? Come have a shot at this boy."
The dogs were barking too.
"They would shame us into folly."
Corin gave John a long look.
"Remember your orders."
"Belike, we need to flush the crows."
Rattleshirt bellowed over the clamour.
"Feather them."
"No!" The word burst from John's lips before the bowman could loose. He took two quick steps forward.
"We yield."
"They warned me bastard blood was craven,"
he heard Corin Halfhand say coldly behind him.
"I see it is so. Run to your new masters, coward."
Face reddening, John descended the slope to where Rattleshirt sat his horse. The wildling stared at him through the eye holes of his helm and said,
"The free folk have no need of cravens."
One of the archers pulled off her sewn sheepskin helm and shook out a head of shaggy red hair. "This is the bastard of Winterfell who spared me. Let him live." John met Ygritte's eyes and had no words.
"Let him die,"
insisted the Lord of Bones.
"The Black Crow is a tricksy bird. I trust him not."
On a rock above them, the eagle flapped its wings and split the air with a scream of fury.
"The bird hates you, Jon Snow," said Ygritte. "And well he might. He was a man before you killed him."
"I did not know," said Jon truthfully, trying to remember the face of the man he had slain in the pass. "You told me Mance would take me."
"And he will,"
Ygritte said.
"Mance is not here," said Rattleshirt. "Ragwile got him."
The big spearwife narrowed her eyes and said,
"If the crow would join the free folk, let him show us his prowess and prove the truth of him."
"I'll do whatever you ask." The words came hard, but John said them. Rattleshirt's bone armor clattered loudly as he laughed.
"Then kill the Halfhand, bastard."
"As if he could," said Corin.
"Turn, Snow, and die."
And then Corin's sword was coming at him, and somehow Longclaw leapt upward to block. The force of impact almost knocked the bastard blade from John's hand and set him staggering backward. "You must not balk, whatever is asked of you." He shifted to a two-handed grip, quick enough to deliver a stroke of his own, but the big ranger brushed it aside with contemptuous ease. Back and forth they went, black cloak swirling, the youth's quickness against the savage strength of Corin's left-hand cuts. The half-hand's longsaw seemed to be everywhere at once, raining down from one side and then the other, driving him where he would, keeping him off balance. Already he could feel his arms growing numb. Even when Ghost Teeth closed savagely around the ranger's calf, somehow Corin kept his feet. But in that instant, as he twisted, the opening was there. John planted and pivoted. The ranger was leaning away, and for an instant it seemed that John's slash had not touched him. Then a string of red tears appeared across the big man's throat, bright as a ruby necklace, and the blood gushed out of him, and Corin Halfhand fell. Ghost's muzzle was dripping red, but only the point of the bastard blade was stained, the last half inch. John pulled the direwolf away and knelt with one arm around him. The light was already fading in Corin's eyes.
"Sharp,"
he said, lifting his mane fingers. Then the hand fell, and he was gone. "He knew," John thought numbly. "He knew what they would ask of me." He thought of Samwell Tarly then, of Gren and Dolores Ed, of Pip and Toad back at Castle Black, Had he lost them all, as he had lost Bran and Rickon and Rob? Who was he now? What was he?
Get him up!
Rough hands dragged him to his feet. John did not resist.
Do you have a name?
Ygritte answered for him.
His name is Jon Snow. He's Eddard Stark's blood of Winterfell. Ragwar laughed. Who would have thought it? Corran Halfpan slain by some lordling's byblow. Got him!
That was Rattleshirt, still a horse. The eagle flew to him and perched atop his bony helm, screeching.
He yielded, Ygritte reminded him. Aye, and slew his brother,
said a short, homely man in a rust-eaten iron half-helm. Rattleshirt rode closer, bones clattering.
The wolf did his work for him. It were foully done. The half-hand's death was mine.
We all saw how eager you were to take it, mocked Ragwile.
Here's a warg, said the Lord of Bones, and a crow. I like him not.
A warg he may be, Ygritte said, but that has never frightened us.
Others shouted agreement. Behind the eye holes of his yellowed skull, Rattleshirt's stare was malignant, but he yielded grudgingly. These are a free folk indeed, thought John. They burned Corran Halfhand where he'd fallen, on a pyre made of pine needles, brush, and broken branches. Some of the wood was still green, and it burned slow and smoky, sending a black plume up into the bright, hard blue of the sky. Afterward, Rattleshirt claimed some charred bones, while the others threw dice for the ranger's gear. Ygritte won his cloak. Will we return by the Skirling Pass? John asked her. He did not know if he could face those heights again, or if his Garen could survive a second crossing.
No, she said. There's nothing behind us. The look she gave him was sad. By now, Mance is well down the Milkwater, marching on your wall.
Bran. The ashes fell like a soft grey snow. He padded over dry needles and brown leaves to the edge of the wood, where the pines grew thin. Beyond the open fields, he could see the great piles of Man Rock stark against the swirling flames. The wind blew hot and rich, with a smell of blood and burnt meat, so strong he began to slaver. Yet as one smell drew them onward, others warned them back. He sniffed at the drifting smoke.
Men, many horses, and fire.
No smell was more dangerous, not even the hard, cold smell of iron, the stuff of man claws and hard skin. The smoke and ash clouded his eyes, and in the sky he saw a great winged snake whose roar was a river of flame. He bared his teeth, but then the snake was gone. Behind the cliffs, tall fires were eating up the stars. All through the night, the fires crackled, and once there was a great roar and a crash that made the earth jump under his feet. Dogs barked and whined, and horses screamed in terror. Howls shuddered through the night, the howls of the man-pack, wails of fear and wild shouts, laughter and screams. No beast was as noisy as man. He pricked up his ears and listened, and his brother growled at every sound. They prowled under the trees as a piney wind blew ashes and embers through the sky. In time, the flames began to dwindle, and then they were gone. The sun rose grey and smoky that morning. Only then did he leave the trees, stalking slow across the fields. His brother ran with him, drawn to the smell of blood and death. They padded silent through the dens that men had built of wood and grass and mud. Many and more were burned, and many and more were collapsed. Others stood as they had before. Yet nowhere did they see or scent a living man.
Crows blanketed the bodies and leapt into the air, screeching when his brother and he came near. The wild dogs slunk away before them. Beneath